Yeah, I'd say so. I feel like I'm going to be good. I know Lance is moving along pretty nicely. I mean, he just needs to clear up what he's got going on. Carlos got a little break, and you know, he's feeling good now. So I think that, you know, we just have our little build up here the last month, and then we're all ready to go.
Welcome back inside the clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. I am David Hall with Bruce Levine until 11 o'clock. That was the voice of Lucas Giolito talking about the White Sox rotation getting healthy in time for the playoffs. And the Score hotline is sponsored by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. And that is where we find our friend Steve Stone, the great NBC Sports Chicago analyst, and also a big help here every day on the Score, talking White Sox. Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm fine, David. How are you?
Doing well. The Sox did not have a great night, and there hasn't been a lot of great news as it pertains to injuries, but also, and that's why it's good that you're here. Provide some context here in terms of, should we look at these as injuries in terms of having Lance Lynn, Lucas Giolito, Tim Anderson on the injured list, or is this orchestrated rest that will do the Sox, you know, is the best thing for them at this time heading into the playoffs?
Well, you certainly can't orchestrate injuries, because that would be probably against the ethics of baseball. So they're obviously
rest.
Injuries.
Yeah.
they're not particularly serious injuries. However, they are nagging injuries. And I think that Tony La Russa has been clear, having won 12 division titles to this point, he realizes that the healthiest team going into the playoffs is the team that's going to come away with a pretty good run into October. And when you take a look at what's going on in the American League, at this particular point, you'll find that there is one team, and that is the Tampa Bay Rays. They are 8 of their last 10 as far as wins are concerned. They also have the best record in the league. Right now, they're probably the team that's playing the best baseball, maybe the best team in the league, but that'll be determined by the playoffs. There's 7 teams that are 6-4 in their last 10, which means that the Sox, who are 6-4 in their last 10, haven't really lost any ground. And that's 10 clicks off the schedule, 9.5 game lead. So I don't think that there's going to be worry time at this point. But you want to make sure that these guys get back. Tim is essential to the ball club. We know the pitchers are essential to the ball club. In fact, the pitching staff is what kept the Sox afloat through all of those major injuries, 4 starters down for a lengthy period of time. And it was the pitching staff going out there every 5th or 6th day, depending on off days. That was the thing that kept this team afloat. Well, the pitching staff has taken a few dings recently, and I expect that Lucas Giolito and Lance Lynn will come back. And when they do, the staff will be fairly well reassembled, and I think they're going to be strong going into the playoffs. And assuming that they can wrap this thing up sooner rather than later, they'll be able to get exactly the rotation in the playoffs that they want to get.
Steve Stone, our guest on Inside the Clubhouse. We're here for you every week between 9 and 11, 52 weeks out of the year, talking baseball on the Score. Steve, help me with these numbers out, okay? We hear an awful lot about the White Sox having the worst record among the contenders for the playoffs against plus 500 teams. But in analyzing these numbers, they've also played the fewest amount of these teams. So they're 29-33 against teams with 500 or better records. But because their division is so average to well below average, they haven't played as many. For instance, Tampa has already played 85 of those type of games. Yankees have played 85 of those type games. Boston, 88 of those games. So what do we make out of those numbers when we look at the White Sox against plus 500 teams, and if they're up to the ability and the chore to win against these teams in the playoffs?
Well, look, having been involved in professional baseball for 52 years, I believe you make nothing of those numbers, because when the playoffs start, those numbers don't mean a damn thing. You just set them aside and say, okay, it wasn't the greatest year against plus 500 teams, and now go get them. The hottest team wins. We've seen the Cardinals win win the World Series with an 83-win team, and I pretty much guarantee you they were under 500 against 500 teams that year. We've also seen a lot of wild card teams win the World Series, and I pretty much guarantee you they were under 500 against 500 teams. Once the playoffs starts, nothing really matters except who's hot, who's healthy, and who's able to string together solid baseball and get 11 wins. That's what it comes down to, because let's assume that the White Sox win the World Series. You think anybody's going to care how they did against under 500 teams during the season? Let's assume that they get knocked out in the first round. Everybody's going to say, well, they couldn't play against plus 500 teams. It's not relevant. What is relevant is, will the pitchers throw well? Will the defense come together? Will they be able to catch the ball behind the plate, which is normally a good thing? And will the hitters start to hit? I like having Grandal back because he gives his team a little balance from the left side. I'd like to see Hernandez hit a little bit better. But Tim at the top means a great deal to this team, and when he comes back and he's healthy, it's going to look like a better offense, certainly.
Steve, big picture question for you, and it might be difficult to put too fine of a point on it, but when you look at the overall impact that Ethan Katz has had on this pitching staff, how would you describe it to people?
Well, look, let me describe it by first giving some accolades to Don Cooper, who for a long time was a very good pitching coach. But there's another voice that came in when Ethan came in, and a guy with instant credibility for a couple of different reasons. Number one, he had a wonderful pitching staff at Harvard Westlake in Los Angeles, which included Lucas Giolito. Number two, he helped design that shorter arm swing, which took Giolito from one of the worst pitchers in baseball to one of the best. And also, he's got a pretty good idea about less is more with these pitchers. I don't believe that he sits on every slider, every changeup, every fastball. I think he gives them his overall philosophy, and it's basically simplistic motion. In other words, get a motion that's repeatable so that you can have control. He's worked wonders with Dylan Cease. If you look at this year with Dylan Cease, it's really been a coming-of-age year for him, and I think he owes a great deal of it to Ethan Katz. I think he's helped young pitchers, certainly. I mean, Lance Lynn is on his own program. Dallas Keuchel is on his own program, and we know that he's really struggling now. But I think overall, you'd have to believe that he's been a plus-plus influence on the pitching staff. And I think one of the reasons why the staff has been as good as it has been this year is that Ethan Katz has done just a great job. He's able to pick out flaws very quickly. He's able to go out, I think you notice, more times than not, when he goes out to the mound to say whatever it is he's going to say, the pitcher picks it up and does pretty well after that. So you can't load him up with too many things, but when you go to the mound, that's actually an art form as far as pitching coaches are concerned. What should I say? What shouldn't I say? Leave him with something positive, and then hopefully he gets out of whatever jam that he's in. I think Ethan does it very well, and he learned a whole lot as the assistant pitching coach with the San Francisco Giants. I think the Sox are very, very happy and very lucky to have him here.
Steve, yesterday, Lucas Giolito said that he has to change his mechanics because of getting lazy and not following through with his pitches, and that he feels there's a good chance that because of that violent leg kick and move backwards that he does throwing his fastball at times, that he might have caused this injury to his hamstring by getting lazy with his mechanics. How difficult is it, knowing your 11-year career and your Cy Young Award-winning season, how difficult is it to just change your mechanics, you know, three-quarters of the way through a season?
Well, I think Lucas completely changed his mechanics one offseason. I don't think he's going to completely change his mechanics. He was talking about pretty much having flexibility in that front leg, his landing leg, and he was talking about the fact that if he has some flexibility, he's not going to go up against that stiff front leg, which maybe jars his delivery at the end. It's a micro adjustment that I think that he'll make, and I think that he'll just be fine with it. But it's one of those things, you know, he is not the most graceful of fielders, as we found out. Lucas is throwing the ball real well, but, you know, when he goes after a ball, especially a little tapper like that, sometimes you hold your breath. Again, you know, he's not Dallas Keuchel on the mound as far as his defense is concerned, but I think he'll work it out. I think when Lucas comes back and he is healthy, I think we'll see pretty much the same pitcher. It's going to be, like I say, a micro adjustment. You're not going to be able to tell too much.
Talking with Steve Stone here on The Score inside the clubhouse until 11 o'clock. Steve, Andrew Vaughn struggling a little bit. I think he has had a terrific rookie year, but since about the middle of August, power numbers are down, 0 for 4 last night. I wonder with as many more options as the Sox might have from the left side of the plate with Gavin Sheets back on the team, could you envision them either resting Vaughn or platooning him more against right-handers?
I think they're very happy with what Andrew has done. You know, it's a learning process in your rookie year. I think what he's done is absolutely remarkable. When you consider, very few ball players are asked to, one, come up to the major leagues. Obviously, we have a lot of rookies that play. But almost without exception, those rookies are not asked to play a position they never played before. So not only has Andrew played left field, and he's played it pretty well, he's also played right field. He's also played second base. I mean, this is a guy that's a lifetime first baseman. Yet he's having to adjust to different positions in the same year where he's learning to hit major league pitchers. So right now what happens is the league has a huge backlog on Andrew Vaughn and what he's doing, what he's not doing. They're not giving him a whole lot of pitches that he hit very well the first half of the season. They're starting to work him over, and that's what happens. And Andrew's a smart hitter, but he's a young hitter. He's going to learn what these guys are trying to do with him, and then he's going to come back and be a whole lot better for it. As far as going forward is concerned, I'm all for Gavin Sheets in the lineup against right-handed starters. Not all of them, but a whole lot of them. He gives the Sox exactly what they need, left-handed power. We've seen it time and time again. And so I think he's probably ready for prime time. We'll have to see just how ready Gavin is. But I think he's a threat when he's in the lineup. I think right-handers especially have to pay attention to him. And there's a world of possibilities, but Andrew is going through what just about every rookie hitter goes through. The league has probably made two or three adjustments to him at this point. Every time they make an adjustment to him, he's going to have to make an adjustment back. And now, obviously, we're under the microscope because you're talking about very few games left for this season. And they're pitching pretty tough to Andrew Vaughn at this point.
Steve, when you look at Grandal, we know he's a good catcher, does great framing, and he's back and healthy again, which is a big, important part of them going forward. But from the overall view of watching playoff baseball, how essential is his bat to be in that lineup from the left side, especially when you know how tough pitching gets when you move into playoff baseball in the postseason, and when you know that the right-handers can basically be pitched to by really good right-handed pitching?
Well, I think anybody who's swinging from the left side is essential against a tough right-hander. I mean, you're talking about some guys, and the guys that the Sox will play in the playoffs, these guys are the top-of-the-line starters and the really good relievers in the bullpen of their respective teams. And look, right now it looks like Tampa Bay, Houston, the Yankees certainly, and probably the way Boston's playing, they've got a really good shot at, especially getting Chris Sale back. Despite having COVID rampant on that team, they're still playing really good baseball. So assuming that it's them and somehow Oakland just dies out of it, they're only winners of four of their last 10 games, and so they're not playing their best baseball, finding them at this point on the outside looking in. Let's assume that it's the five teams we're talking about with Boston and the Yankees as the wild card. You're going to face a lot of really tough right-hand pitchers. All of these teams have them, and that's going to be the case. So Grandal becomes very much important because, number one, if you don't pitch to him, he will take a walk, meaning he's on base to be driven in by somebody else. But if you do leave something out over the plate, he usually hits it pretty hard at this point. He worked out his mechanics. I think the leg is fine. I think he's going to catch the lion's share of the catching in the playoffs. And then, we'll have to see exactly exactly where he fits and what he's doing. I like the way he's been swinging the bat. I like the fact that his on-base percentage continues to be astronomical when you look at his batting average especially. So he's important to this team.
Steve, you know we love to debate the lineup decisions by Tony La Russa and the media, and certainly Sox fans. That's a favorite hobby of the summer. So
that's part of it, yeah.
It's all part of it. And Luis Robert has come back, and he has been so hot, and he's so much fun to watch. And we asked Ozzie Guillen this the other morning on Mully and Haw, and to get his perspective as well. Where would you bat him ideally? Against lefties, does he bat second? Against righties, does he drop lower for Moncada at second? Or where is the most ideal spot? When Tim Anderson comes back and you have your idealized White Sox lineup, where is the best spot for Luis Robert?
I wish I could tell you. I don't really know. Anderson's going to be leadoff, and then you can pretty much mix and match after that. I mean, you know, if you go with Luis in the second spot, then you're facing four straight right-handers at the top of the lineup. You're facing Tim, you're facing Luis, you're facing Jose, and you're facing Eloy. That'll be the first four, and, you know, we've talked about the fact that guys with well-placed fastballs and hard sliders from the right side, those guys get a lot of right-hand hitters out anyway. But I don't know if I'm locked into the two spot with him. I do think that he is going to be, down the road, a prolific run producer. I don't think right now we've seen the finished product because, quite obviously, he hasn't played that many major league games. But he is going to be a star. There's no doubt about it. I don't think you can go wrong with wherever they place him in the lineup. But, you know, why don't you tell me who's going to start against him, and I'll tell you where to put him in the lineup. But you can't tell me who's going to start against him because they don't know. Let's wait and see who starts against the Sox. Then we can figure out where Luis best fits.
David and I appreciate your time, Stoney. I can't let you go without giving you some accolades about you and Jason being named the best broadcast team among the 30. What are your thoughts about that, and you know, just working with Jason and enjoying each and every game?
Well, there's no doubt that we bring a unique style of broadcasting. And the one thing that I can say is, number one, there's some wonderful broadcasting teams. Those guys in San Francisco are just great. The Mets are just great. I mean, you look up and down, Tampa Bay has wonderful broadcasters. My former partner, Dwayne Statz. There's a lot of guys that are really good at what they do. And I think a lot of guys who professionally approach each and every game to the best of their ability. But the one thing that I can say about Jason and I is that we don't sound like anybody else. You can listen to the broadcast for one out or two outs and realize that even if you don't recognize the voices, you know that's our broadcast because it's unique. There's nobody like us, which is something that you strive for as far as a broadcast is concerned. You try to bring a certain amount of education, which we do. We bring some levity, which we also do that. You bring some insight, and you bring some lighter moments because there's a lot of downtime in baseball. In some instances, baseball is the toughest sport to do because you've got, at times, 3.5 hours to fill, and you got to do it and bring everything to the table. You have to keep viewers interested even when the team is not doing particularly well. I think Jason and I do a nice job at that. It's wonderful to work with him. He's a great broadcaster, going to continue to be a great broadcaster regardless of what sport he does. Hopefully he'll be with the White Sox a long time. I tend to think that he will be, and we'll see. But thanks, guys. I appreciate the time. Have a good rest of the show, and I'll talk to you down the road.
Congratulations,
Steve. You're the best.
Steve.
Thank you.
Yep, you're the best. Steve Stone, NBC Sports Chicago, Sox analyst, score expert, and just all-around good guy joining us on a Saturday morning, Bruce. And that was terrific to get the Sox perspective from the best in the business. When we come back, more White Sox talk here on Inside the Clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. Inside the Clubhouse here, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score with Bruce Levine. I am David Haw, talking baseball till 11 o'clock like we do 52 Saturday mornings a year. Bruce, great conversation with Steve Stone. I got to follow up. I got to ask you about your response because you asked a really good question, and you asked a question that I think is on the minds of every White Sox fan who is concerned, and maybe even White Sox critic would be a better way to put it, maybe they're one and the same, the record against 500 teams, the record against teams that are winning teams, teams you're going to see in the playoffs, and how those numbers either inform or project playoff success. Bruce, I think it's a good question. I think it's a fair question. I was a little surprised that Steve Stone said, you know what, those numbers, to quote Stoney, don't mean a damn thing. And that, well, interesting.
He's sitting at the table with a big stack in front of him, okay? If it's a card table and we're playing poker, he's got the biggest stack because the White Sox have a 9.5 game lead. So they're going to the playoffs, right? Regardless of their record against plus 500 teams, they're going to the playoffs. And he knows, like we all know, that it's the hot team that gets into the playoffs, not necessarily the team that has performed the best against the best teams. He's right about that. But I'm asking you, David, the White Sox have only played 62 such games, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. I think that's important when you look at this because the Yankees and Tampa Rays and the Red Sox have all played in this order. Tampa, 85.
Okay.
That's 26 more than the Sox.
Right.
The Yankees, 85, 26 more than the, or 23 more than the Sox. And Boston, 88, 26 more than the Sox. So, and all the other playoff contenders, even Toronto, 91 of those games. Seattle, 70 of those type of games, all over 500 against teams that have 500 records. So, again, is it because of the White Sox division that, well, they don't have a better team, better record in those type of games?
You got to consider that as well. I mean, you can't control who you play. And if you're asking me this morning on September 4th, Saturday morning, with the White Sox, you know, still having in the midst of a season where they are 78-57, Bruce, to check a box, yes or no, do you agree with Stoney, or do you go the other way? I'm inclined to go more that they don't mean as much as maybe some people are afraid,
right,
that they do, because, you know, you've seen it so often, Bruce, and his points about the Cardinals are good ones. You get a, if your starting rotation is peaking at the right time, if you get a hot streak from Lynn, Giolito, and Rodon in a series, it's not going to matter what you did in July or August. It's not going to matter that you know, we're bum slayers, to use the word that is commonly heard when talking about the White Sox. So I would think that I tend to agree with Stoney when he said this to your question.
Well, look, having been involved in professional baseball for 52 years, I believe you make nothing of those numbers, because when the playoffs start, those numbers don't mean a damn thing. You just set them aside and say, okay, it wasn't the greatest year against plus 500 teams, and now go get them. The hottest team wins. We've seen the Cardinals win the World Series with an 83-win team, and I pretty much guarantee you they were under 500 against 500 teams that year. We've also seen a lot of wild card teams win the World Series, and I pretty much guarantee you they were under 500 against 500 teams. Once the playoff starts, nothing really matters except who's hot, who's healthy, and who's able to string together solid baseball and get 11 wins.
Say it a little louder for the people in the back, Stoney.
Look, David, maybe I have some better numbers for you.
Okay.
The White Sox were 13-12 in July. They were 16-12 in August, okay? So that, and 1-1 so far this month. So what it points to is their better months were earlier in the season, okay? The pitching has not been as good. It hasn't been as healthy, okay? So maybe that supports exactly what I was getting to and what Steve said, because he said the hottest team is the teams that are going to be the most scary going into the playoffs. I agree with him. But unless your pitching is healthy and ready to go, you're not going to be the hottest team, okay? The offense is only going to carry you so far. Once they get those guys back, then I think both his way of looking at it and mine will be answered very well. I don't think there's a wrong here right now.
I tend to agree with that, okay? You can see it both ways. Dr. Bruce. So tell me this. Let's go with another direction. we talk about the whether or not the record versus 500 teams or not matters, and I think it's all sort of related. Stoney's also talked about, and I think we would agree with this, you want to be healthy going into the postseason, so you take your foot off the gas a little bit, and you have this orchestrated rest that we have talked about. But does it concern you at all, Bruce? The White Sox have such a different performance level at home versus the road, where you could maybe justify playing and going all out, as La Russa might be inclined to do, to get that home field advantage, because you are a different team. You do have a higher batting average by 10 points, 258 at home, 248 on the road. You hit 94 home runs at home, 69 on the road, and your team ERA is 3.54 at home compared to 3.99 on the road. Are those things worth chasing or preserving, or is rest the ultimate priority?
It's a really great question, because you want to be – you want to have that first series at home, so you want that record to improve, so you don't get passed up by Houston. Tampa is going to have a better record than anybody, so they're automatically going to have a home game. But you want to have that second best record, so you have the ability to have the home series and the NLDS. I don't know. I mean, this is probably. A lot of teams, a lot of cities would love to have a 9.5 game lead,
totally.
And worried about where people are going to end up,
yes.
Hosting or not hosting right now. There's only a couple teams, Milwaukee and the White Sox, that can have those conversations right now.
Bruce, that's the fun of it. That's why it's so much fun, kind of getting these different opinions on, okay, whether or not the White Sox are going to be bum slayers going into the playoffs, and whether that matters, or what does their home versus road record mean going into October. You know why? Because we're going into October, and here we are, the first weekend in September, Labor Day weekend, a good mile marker for the baseball season, and the White Sox, they're relevant. They are the fourth best team in the American League, whom you might have the best collection of talent when healthy in the American League. You can say they're in a World Series or bust type of mentality, and it's fun to consider what happens next. That is why we're here. That's what we're talking about until 11 o'clock. More baseball talk when we come back with Bruce Levine. I'm David Haw. This is Inside the Clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. Welcome back inside the clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score with Bruce Levine. I'm David Haw, here until 11 o'clock, talking baseball, Cubs, Sox, and everything else going on around the league. Bruce, just to close the loop, and I know that we have talked about this White Sox thing with Stoney and had a lot of fun kind of debating back and forth. Our loyal listener, Mark Gonzalez, longtime Chicago Tribune beat writer, covered both World Series champions in town, by the way, one of the few guys, only guys to ever do that. He points out, Steve Stone was part of the 1971 Giants team back in San Francisco, his rookie year. They were 9-3 against the Pittsburgh Pirates in the regular season, and then they lost to the Pirates in the NL Championship Series, 3-1. Maybe that left an indelible impression that, you know what, happens in the regular season doesn't always translate into the postseason, and it left a deep impression, and that's the only one of many examples to point to what happens in the regular season doesn't always carry over.
Oh, I agree with that. I'm just looking at the White Sox right now. That's all I'm concerned with. I'm not concerned with their record against good teams at this point. I agree with Steve that if your team is healthy and it's playing good baseball, you got as good a chance as anybody, regardless if you're playing away or at home. I think there's been six wild card teams that have won World Series over the years. So from that perspective, it is the hot team. But my concern for the White Sox is getting these guys healthy and prepared to pitch in the playoffs. So, you know, Giolito is going to miss one or two starts. Keiko, with Lynn, one or two starts. Rodon is still nursing, that shoulder. You see him going out there. The great thing is that he's learned how to pitch so well that he's getting people out and pitching five innings throwing 92 and 93, not the 98 that he was throwing earlier in the year. So there's some good signs. And Dylan Cease has come on to be one of the top pitchers in the game already with, I think it's 7 or 8 double-digit strikeout games this year. He has been phenomenal lately. So it's not all doom and gloom. I just try to look at the reality of the situation right now. Who are the White Sox right now, David? Who are they going to be in 3 weeks, you know, when we're getting ready for the playoffs? Actually, 4 weeks from now, because the playoffs begin, I think, the 4th or 5th of October. So from that perspective, my only angst for the White Sox is not whether they played 500 or better against good teams, but are they going to have those competitive pitchers at full strength when they start the playoffs?
Good question, Bruce. Totally understand that. White Sox back in action tonight in Kansas City against the Royals. Ronaldo Lopez on the mound. For the Cubs, they go back to Wrigley Field this afternoon. 1:20 first pitch. Kyle Hendricks against the Pirates. Pregame here on the Score with Zach Zaidman at 12:45.
David, I got one thing to say. If the playoffs started today, Dylan Cease would be your number one pitcher. Okay.
Bruce.
Rodon would go in game 2, and Lopez would likely go in game 3.
Well, is that because Lance Lynn and Lucas Giolito are on the injured list, or because you think Dylan Cease has
done? Of course, I'm saying if it started today.
They don't start today.
And because Keuchel has been wonky, to say the least, okay? You want Lopez or Keuchel out there to start game 3 today?
Final word on Keuchel.
The playoffs today. Hey, David, the playoffs starting today.
Today? September at 7:20
It's starting
today.
Is it Cease, Rodon, and Lopez? Are those your three starters?
Okay. Yes, because Dylan Cease, to your point, and it's a good one, he has come a long way. 24, I think, of his 29 starts, Bruce, he's allowed 3 runs or fewer. The consistency that has eluded him, he has found somehow this year because of maybe some little adjustments. Maybe he's just good, better above the shoulders. He's always had the stuff, and he's got the stuff now. I said in April, if you remember one of our bold predictions, I said that Dylan Cease was going to be your game one starter for the White Sox in the playoffs. I don't know if that's going to be the case. I hope it's not the case because that would mean Lance Lynn's not available. But the overall point is a good one. Dylan Cease has become reliable as a starting pitcher for the White Sox. And that's great to see when production meets up with potential.
You know what I love when radio hosts are right and they remind people that they were.
Bruce, you led me down that road. Now you smack me in the face.
You did a sensational job of doing that just now, because we didn't go back to get the tape. But
no,
in reality,
next week.
This would be. You know, the situation right now. I live in the here and now world, okay?
Okay.
I mean...
Yeah, I know.
I mean, you're counting on 2 injured pitchers to be at their peak when they start. I'm hoping and I'm assuming, I hate to use that word, I'm assuming that they will be at their peak when these playoffs start. But right now you're dealing with 2 very essential injured pitchers.
Context changes weekly, if not more often.
In sports radio, every 5 minutes.
Exactly. Well, every 5 minutes is sports talk radio. We'll be back after this, and we'll change our context and our opinion. So, Bruce, let's take a step backward and take the 35,000-foot view of Major League Baseball around the league and in the game. And this week, odd to see this, and needed to get to this because I know you've been paying attention, and every baseball fan should. September 8th, that is Wednesday. That is when the newest class for baseball's Hall of Fame will be inducted. Why on a Wednesday? And who among the class? Derek Jeter, Ted Simmons, Larry Walker, and Marvin Miller. Those are the 4 members of the class of 2020, which will now be inducted in September 8th of 2021. What stands out about that class to you, Bruce, and how closely will you be paying attention Wednesday?
Well, look, Ted Simmons has been a longtime friend of mine. I'm thrilled for Ted. And Jeter, what can you say about Jeter? He is your everyman baseball player who got every little bit of talent out of his body to become one of the great players, not the greatest talents, but one of the greatest players in baseball history. When I say player, I mean he wasn't a great physical shortstop. He didn't have a great arm. He didn't hit a lot of home runs. He didn't hit 300 every year. But what he did do was accumulate 3,000 hits, play and lead as the captain of the Yankees, four World Series teams, seven teams that went to the World Series. When you say Derek Jeter's name, the next word that comes up is fill in the blank, David. It's
winner.
Winner. Yes, winner. Sir. And that is what the game is all about. That helps us segue into me asking him a question about the other day he was on a Zoom call. And I asked Jeter the question about what is and what has always been most important to him.
I think what people need to understand is there's the most important thing when you're playing is to win. And I've said this before, I don't know if you've heard me say it before, probably not, but I think one of the things that is an issue for, you know, some players nowadays is, you know, you go to all these showcases, right, and it's all about how hard you throw, how fast you run, how far you can hit it. And then when you get players, you need to teach them how to win. You know, winning is something that you have to learn to do. It doesn't come easy. You know, there's a way to do it. There's a way to play the game, and there's a way to be unselfish. So I think, you know, one thing we try to do in our organization, we try to teach everyone how to win. And that's a process. It takes a little bit of time. But I think people need to understand that the ultimate goal is for you to win.
Derek Jeter, the consummate winner, the pride of Kalamazoo, and one of the greatest Yankees ever, talking on earlier this week on Wednesday about his induction into the Baseball Hall of Fame and what it takes and what he values most. Bruce, that's a good question, and what a terrific answer.
Well, again, he was not the most talented guy playing out there. There were other guys more talented than him. He just happened to have a baseball IQ of over 200. You know, I mean, it was through the sky, and his work ethic and his determination to win and be a team player was off the charts. So when you look at Derek Jeter, you have to have nothing but admiration for the fact that he was everything that the game is about. What I wanted to ask him, and I didn't, and I'll ask you, David, is where does baseball find the next Derek Jeters out there to be able to come up and be able to be signed at a high level, to be able to be developed, and to get into the games now when we see the anti-Derek Jeter groups out there mostly in the launch angle era that we're in?
It's a good question. I don't know that you're going to find somebody that epitomizes, you know, just the class and the winning approach and willing to sacrifice certain things about, you know, his game throughout the way. So he's rare, and he's going into the Hall of Fame because of that rarity, because of how unique his skill set and approach and mindset is and was for the Yankees. But when you say that, Bruce, I think you're talking about a player who spends the entire career with the same organization, somebody who plays at a high level and wins championships, plural, with that organization. And I have to say this, I don't want to, without looking at the numbers, but the same kind of idea, what you're talking about, the intangibles matched with the batting approach, the skill at the plate, and the championship aura that surrounds him. Tim Anderson comes to mind. I mean, Tim Anderson in Chicago has a chance with the White Sox to spend his entire career with the team that drafted him, win multiple championships, win multiple batting titles, be the kind of winner, and be the, I don't want to, dare I say, you know, comparing him to a Hall of Famer, but be Chicago Jeter in a way because of his longevity here, potentially, if he stays healthy and he continues the arc in which he has started.
Well, I think that's an interesting premise because you're right. Anderson has some of those skill set that Jeter had, and that is He's not going to hit 40 home runs, but he's going to hit 15 to 25. He makes all the plays in the field, and his energy is important part of White Sox winning. Look at the team record when he's not on the field as opposed to when he's on. There's a big difference. So we're light years away from him being going into the Hall of Fame, but he certainly has credentials that if he continues to play at this level and be the leader on his team that he has been, that he can go there. We should probably spend a minute, and we got a minute or two left,
yep,
talking about Marvin Miller, who had probably the most impact on baseball of any man in the history of the game, more than Babe Ruth, more than Judge Landis, more than any great player or executive in the game of baseball. And the reason for that is he took the players out of being servants into being respected guys who have the strongest union in that's ever occurred in the United States of America as far as benefits and being able to continue to make the most money in their field. He was just a brilliant man, a brilliant leader, and somebody that should be admired, probably not by all the owners and the previous owners that had to deal with him, but the reality of his impact, not just on baseball, David, but on all sports and how people get paid.
Well put, Bruce. Marvin Miller, Ted Simmons, Larry Walker, Derek Jeter, that is the 2020 class of the Baseball Hall of Fame going in, inducted on Wednesday, 2021, because of the pandemic. Bruce, and before we get out of here, breaking news on the score is brought to you by DuckDuckGo. Protect your privacy online for free with DuckDuckGo. DuckDuckGo, privacy simplified. Wilson Contreras, the Cubs have announced, is coming off the injured list. He will be activated today. Keegan Thompson placed on the 10-day injured list with right shoulder inflammation.
David, we have Steve Stone to thank. We have Adam Studzinski to thank. Special thank you to Mitch Rosen, our boss, for helping us with Steve Stone as well. People can follow me on Twitter at MLB Bruce Levine. Also, I write on our website every day on 670thescore.com. Enjoyed it very much, David. Talk to you next week.
Thanks, Bruce. 12:45 pregame, Zach Zaidman, Cody Decker, noon down the line, 11 o'clock next, Mark Grody. Thank you for listening. Inside the Clubhouse, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.